Hello and welcome to episode 121 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston.
Hello, Matt. It's one of those palindromic episodes where we have got a special number, 121, to mark the, how many years now we've been doing this. It must be 3 years. Have we got an anniversary coming up? Because we kind of started it. It was not autumn, wasn't it, when we started it?
Yeah, in October we'll be having our third anniversary, which is remarkable, really. Well done, us.
Yeah, we should pat ourselves on the back. Should we make it and no, you know, not our giant meteor ends at all between now and then, or the we don't have any power on the internet because of Brexit calamity, then yeah, we should definitely pat ourselves on the back. So what sort of a week has it been for you?
It has been mostly a week of experimenting with a new card game, which I can't remember whether I'd started when we spoke last. I think I was just starting it. Mm. And what I've done is produce a thing that brings together a model that the Leading Edge Forum have had for about 3 years and have never really quite brought to life, and the improvisational theatre game Yes And, and I've created a new game called Innovation Yes And, and I've been trialing it out with some people, and I'm doing some more trials this week, and I think I'm going to take, because I've got I'm going to be at the IT Directors Forum in a couple of weeks' time, so I think I'll pilot a few games of it up there as well, which would be good. And so that's been a large part of it. There was a recruitment exercise that I've been a part of, which is still continuing. So there's a an interesting potential career diversion going on there, but we will see. And I am ignoring football and become a rugby fan because the Irish are doing very well in the rugby, and that's enough of any conversation about sport.
Well, indeed. Well, other than rugby scores appear to be in vogue in football at the moment. particular ground.
Yes.
Yes.
You had a European tour, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. Because last week when we did the podcast, I was happily ensconced in the Emerald Isle, which was fine, at the IDC CIO Europe Summit, which was really interesting, and as much as it was my first opportunity to see one of the IDC CIO events close up and meet a lot of people, not just from the customer base, but also from IDC as well, because IDC is pretty distributed and people are spread all around the world. So you often, you only get to meet them every now and again. So that was good. And then I went on, as you say, a bit of a kind of tour to different places, via Austria to Bratislava in Slovakia, where I spoke at their CIO event, and that was great. In as much as, again, I met some people, I met some CIOs there, had a few one-to-one conversations, but on the downside, or the rest of the conference was in Czech, and since my Czech is somewhat limited to the few words that I learned when I was there, I did learn very briefly, where is the breakfast? But now I've even forgotten what that is. It was all a little bit baffling, but still, it was good, and I was glad to be there, and because I'd not been to Bratislava before, so you always have to take an opportunity to go to places you've not been. And then I went back to Vienna for some more meetings, and that was nice as well, because actually I thought I'd been before, but when I got there, I realised I really hadn't been to Vienna before, and it was and it's very grand, and I recommend it.
Yes, one of the centres of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you're going to have a sort of huge, scary empire, then I think Vienna is exactly the kind of place you'd want as its capital, really. It's got all of those sort of big, imposing buildings, and, it cares nothing for mortal man. So, yeah, so I was quite impressed. If I do ever destroy the world like an almighty colossus, then I'll probably pick Vienna as my headquarters.
Oh, it's good to see you drop the cliches of having a big mountain-based island with rockets coming out of it and just gone for the 19th century European charm.
It's all a bit 60s, isn't it? The volcano base or things like that.
It is. It is indeed. So what we have on the show coming up tonight We have noticed that we've kind of dropped a lot of our features recently, and we're going to kind of whir some of those back into action, maybe bring in a few new ones soon as well. But we're kind of still, I think we're still basically coming to terms with it not being the summer holidays anymore. It's taken us a while to get back out of the long holiday rut.
Well, it is, and I'm slightly depressed by the fact it's dark when we record this, and then it hasn't been dark up until like just quite recently, and it's really come in really quickly. Suddenly, yeah, from being light at night to dark at night very quickly, and I don't like it.
The autumn equinox was about 12 hours ago from the point of this recording, so that's it. We're in for the winter now. Put your coats on.
I don't like it.
What we do have on tonight's show is though a really interesting interview with a chap called Tobias Cormand, who is the chief executive of a company called 77 Diamonds. And 77 Diamonds are an online jewellery and diamond retailer. And so I went to go and have a chat with Tobias about the world of online jewellery and jewellers, and how do you get people to be able to buy things of high value and high trust.
My name is Tobias Cormand. I'm the managing director of 77 Diamonds, which is the leading online diamond jeweler in the UK and actually in Europe. We make fine jewelry on a made-to-order basis, mainly with diamonds, and we manufacture that ourselves and we sell directly to consumers.
And tell me a bit about the genesis of the business, because you're not, you've been around for a while.
Yeah, we have. So we're one of the early players in the space. There was a couple of American companies that were established a few years before us and showed that it was possible, because there was a huge amount of skepticism in the marketplace about whether anybody would purchase diamond jewelry online. And obviously that's, you know, it's one of the fastest growing segments of the jewelry space. For me personally, it started, I came out of finance, so a completely different background. My sister married into a diamond family, and as I was growing up, I was introduced to diamonds. A few of my friends were getting engaged, and they knew that I had some access and sourcing capability, so they asked for some help, and I had to run around and figure out how to make an engagement ring for them. But when I established some online businesses with my business partners, and I decided that doing diamond jewelry online would be a really good idea, based on the fact that I was getting calls from friends of my friends and so on. There seemed to be real demand out there for it. And so we launched, kind of a price-led proposition, which undercut the high street. And from there, it grew to a much more complex retail business, where actually we've tried to build the business around the consumer, to make sure that they can purchase, at their convenience. And things like, I didn't understand retail in the beginning, but obviously I've learned a hell of a lot along the way. But making sure that, there are showrooms that they can come in and actually talk to somebody. And also the craftsmanship and quality of build means we've got our own workshop, which some of the finest craftsmen in the UK, which is a little bit of a dying industry, but we're training new people through as well. So we've got apprentices. So not just the excellent superior craftsmanship, but also kind of a huge array and selection at very affordable prices, with combined with a luxury customer service experience, really gives kind of a second to none experience for our customers.
That question about things that people wouldn't buy online is an interesting one. If you think back to the early days, because you were going from the early or mid 2000s.
Yeah, so we kind of launched at the end of 2005, but it was really run as a hobby for quite a few years. So yeah. It's kind of the serious launch of the business was 2009. The early days, I mean, it was definitely people at the leading edge of experimentation online in terms of purchasing behavior. So the early adopters, so we would get people coming in who had done a ton of research, were very price conscious, and really were looking at all the different aspects of the diamonds, the ability to shine, basically. So kind of the geeks, and that was our first customer base. The positive thing about that was that we had to really up our game to fulfill their requirements and needs, and they were complicated customers. And I think once we were able to build a business around that and be able to service that type of customer base, as we started getting award-winning designers on board to, you know, for our collections, we were able to expand the offering and create a more luxury environment with the fundamentals being really strong about, you know, the diamond aspects and diamond selection. And we kind of took that and we rolled that out into the craftsmanship and the manufacturing of the jewelry, as well as the customer service. So we, you know, we had to up our game kind of across the board.
What does the rest of the market look like? Presumably you've got people who sell pre-designed rings with the high street jewelry chains.
Yeah.
And then you've got, is it mostly then small businesses that you're in competition with, or?
So I would say that we're kind of taking market share from everybody, as well as embracing the people who are moving across from high street to online. Our business is built to basically attack almost all the different segments, because you're absolutely right. The high street will pre-manufacture. A lot of what they do is they'll, you know, a lot of, unfortunately, the manufacturing has moved overseas, and they'll, you know, they'll buy diamonds in bulk. They will be self-certified, which means they're not independently certified, and they'll do kind of a rough grading on the diamonds. And then they'll mass manufacture in a offshore manufacturing capability, and then they'll distribute that through the chain of high street stores that they own. So that's one way of doing it. And somebody, you know, they probably won't own their own manufacturing. They'll outsource that. And with smaller high street stores, they, you know, very rarely will manufacture themselves because of the cost of having a workshop. So there's only a few specialists will actually be able to, you know, offer that service, or you have kind of a designer, maker, jeweler, so kind of all in one, so they'll actually make, you know, that'll be very low volume, which is wonderful. I think that's, you know, that's great, and it's keeping up the tradition, because that's how it all used to be. You've got a few people able to offer kind of more of a strong online offering. It's mainly the US players. And a few European players as well that's able to do that. And I think the big difference with us is that when you walk into a high street store, they want to sell you what they have. With us, it's we're here to actually guide a customer. Mm-hmm. So it's really about what you want, and we'll educate you, and we'll make sure you understand the differences in color and clarity. And then because our website has the largest selection in the world, we're giving you almost the entire diamond market access. You can have, you know, whatever specifications you want at the best possible price. And that, you know, it's a very, very strong proposition. But it also means we don't have an agenda to try and sell you something, you know, here.
So you don't hold the stock of everything that's on your website. That's you're acting as an aggregator for the market.
In a way, yes. I mean, we do obviously have a good stock. So if people want to come in and pick something, they absolutely can with us. We even have some pre-made, you know, items as well, but in general, it's a made-to-order business, and it's very much an access to a virtual inventory. But it's not, the inventory is not sitting in the diamond trading centers around the world. It's actually sitting with the people who've cut and polished the rough, and those people have the contracts for supply from the miners, like De Beers, which is now owned by Anglo American, you know, one of the other, like Dominion, for example, in Canada. And that means we're basically accessing it at source. There's no middlemen, and we're passing all of that on to the consumer, so they get not only the biggest selection, but the you know, great value as well.
So technology within your business operates at a number of levels. You're an e-commerce, to use the old terms, business, so you've obviously got
we're a digital native, so this business was founded, you know, on technology, and technology is our lifeblood. Actually, today every part of the business is integrated, and so I'm through technology mainly. But every, you know, the workshop that we have here is just as important as our developers, which is just as important as our sales team. They all have to kind of work together in the kind of cliche of, you know, synchronized swimming. But I think, you know, fundamentally what underpins us, we have no legacy systems, which comes obviously with some downside, but has a huge amount of upside, because anything is possible. And so if we can think it, if our customers want it, we can do it, and we can do it quickly. And that's given us, you know, a massive edge over a lot of the traditional competitors.
So if I think through some of the areas of the business and where the technology has to play, so in terms of the manufacture of the finished product, you're using technology within that, from being able to produce the jewelry itself,
so
to be able to demonstrate what it will be like before it's produced.
So first of all, we have a state-of-the-art website which gives you all the power and choice, and without the selling pressure. So in your own time, you can look at things in much more closer detail in 3D visuals, and you know, many of it is HD quality as well. So you can really sit and ponder about, you know, the diamond specs, the inclusions, you know, which is the impurities inside the diamonds, whether they're acceptable or not. Looking at the ring or the necklace or the pendant in from every single angle, making sure that you're absolutely happy with the product. You're not being rushed into a decision making. So from that's kind of the front end consumer perspective. But then that, you know, integrates with our back end and supply chain, because the supply chain is all made to order, just in time manufacturing. So we've got this, you know, virtual inventory for the consumer in terms of the diamonds, and then we produce the jewelry on a made to order basis.
And you're starting to, well, you've been using 3D printing as part of that process for a while, but you're starting to look at how you might be able to do actual 3D printing to manufacture as well.
Absolutely. So technology has come a long way in the jewelry industry. It's really been changing how we can work, but our capability and our precision has increased, you know, many fold. If you just look at the cutting of a rough diamond, so actually, like wood, diamonds have a grain, believe it or not, and so they used to cleave the diamond along the grain, which means that if you wanted to extract, you know, a perfect diamond out of the rough and cutting outside the impurities inside the rough diamond, you wouldn't be able to do that because you could only cleave it in a certain way. And today we have laser technology that literally goes in and cuts, you know, all kind of different parameters out of the rough to get the maximum yield out of a rough stone, and you can get a much purer diamond as a result of that, and the utilization of the diamond, of the rough diamond, is much better. So that's on the diamond front. On the jewelry front, our workshop has a laser machine to basically fuse metal together, as opposed to solder metal, which is how we used to do it. That creates a much stronger integrity structure for the jewelry. Our setters use microscopes so they can get into, you know, minutiae detail and make sure that the items are created perfectly symmetrical and are robust and last a lifetime. And then we've done things like moving from 3D printing with creating a mold and being able to cast the jewelry itself. We're now experimenting. It's very new technology where we can actually 3D print, not into a plastic or wax and then create a mold, but actually from the pure gold or platinum powder, to be able to actually 3D render jewelry. And eventually that will allow for further precision, so we can build structures completely around, you know, a diamond down to micromillimeters.
Interesting. Presumably then also creating structures that just couldn't have been produced through traditional methods of manufacture.
Absolutely. And it's not just that, but the integrity of the structure. So you'd have to cast many more pieces, and instead now you can build almost the entire piece, maybe in just two parts, where it would have to be in 10 parts. So the integrity of the structure and the uniqueness of it is, you know, is much greater, and it does open up for possibility of things that just we weren't able to do before. So I think you're going to see a lot more innovative designs, and it's, you know, for us it's about much greater fulfillment of the imagination of what the clients can come up with. So our business, not only do we offer, you know, designs on the website, but we've got the ability to work with our bespoke team and literally create anything from the client's imagination, as long as it won't fall apart or, you know, it's feasibly possible.
I see this just in perspective from the use of the technology to be able to change what a designer can do with end product. As an old school friend of mine who's a fine artist, and she's just been experimenting recently with Tilt Brush, which is the virtual reality software that Google have created that enables you to paint in space.
Yeah.
And she's now starting to do things which fuse together her traditional, she does abstract
work and creating fusions between virtual and physical world.
Yeah.
But that actually, I mean, that's quite progressive thinking for a designer or a creative mind to be able to start to think about the opportunity that...
For the real world.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a really... And how do designers get their heads around that?
I think designers are usually part of the cutting edge community that pushes society forward, and so you know they're going to be the first people to embrace and adopt and set the way. And I think lots of practical things will probably come out of that. And for us, it's maybe hard to get our heads around it. Like, you know, quantum theory has changed computing, and you know these were all theoretical concepts that actually ended up in reality and changing the way we're able to produce and make and think about things. So I think maybe not quite as sophisticated as that, but I think it will open up possibilities within the jewelry space, and probably start to see radical different jewelry that was never possible before, which are going to be much more personalized. So that's definitely a big trend that we're seeing in the jewelry space already now, and that's why bespoke jewelry is really in demand, because people understand that what's possible today wasn't possible 10 years ago, and actually they can have it their way and they can have something completely unique, which is much more meaningful than going into a traditional shop and buying something pre-manufactured that was made somewhere overseas.
Yeah, absolutely. The diamond industry is also one where over the years there's been controversy, particularly related to the provenance of where things have come from, and technology is having a role to play within that.
So absolutely. So I would like to show you, but it's kind of, I'll describe. So first of all, we're working with our supply chain on the diamond side to have origin assurance, so that we know where every diamond comes from. You have companies like Everledger that have started to use blockchain so that there is traceability from a rough stone all the way to a final finished product. We offer a certificate, which I have in front of me here, which actually shows you the rough diamond, the Kimberley process number, the mine that it actually comes from, the outline of the finished diamond that came out of the rough, and that accompanies the certificate. So we can offer that on every, we're starting to work with our supply chain to offer that. And so we've already got a few where we're able to show our customers that. So the origin assurance is, I think, incredibly important. We get a lot of questions from our customers about where their diamonds actually come from. And part of that is the kind of conflict diamond discussion that has been. But I think people in general are much more curious about the sourcing and manufacturing of things. And that's why we're very proud to have our workshop, here based in Mayfair, where our headquarters are as well, so that, if customers want to see their product being manufactured or make some amendments, all of these things are kind of are possible, to cater kind of to their needs and demands. But I think within a few years, the whole diamond industry will have changed radically, and it'll be the norm that every diamond has an origin certificate and assurance.
And are there standards and data standards that exist across the industry to be able to enable that to happen, or is this individual initiatives at the moment?
So there are industry initiatives. So the big certification body, which is the GIA, Gemmological Institute of America, is actually working with the blockchain technology now, so that you're going to start to have traceability the whole way through, produced as a standard for every diamond. I think we're probably 18 months away from being able to see that. So the industry is definitely behind it, but it started with individual initiatives and blockchain companies kind of approaching and working with and collaborating with. And it's partially driven by consumers, but I think people have been quite forward-thinking in trying to make the industry move, into the next generation.
And how do you tie back the documentation, whether that's physical or digital, to the actual diamond? Is there some sort of fingerprint?
Fantastic question, actually. And this is one of the big conundrums that they obviously have, is how do you know that the electronic signature of this diamond is actually this diamond? So what they've done until now is they have a laser inscription on the girdle, which is like the belt of the diamond, so that the certificate number matches the the diamond and you can check it. Yeah. And of course, fraudsters are able to replicate that. So it's kind of, I think until now, you need quite sophisticated technology to be able to, you know, imprint a tiny little invisible inscription on the diamond. But it is possible, people have been caught, you know, doing that. But in general, that's quite a safe way of doing it. But actually, the technology is now evolving. Every diamond is a fingerprint. It's unique. So even two diamonds that weigh the same, you know, will have very slight differences.
So in terms of the cut, all the way down, the color, the flaws,
all of that stuff, the flaws exactly down, you know, we can get quite sophisticated. So eventually you can go down to the atomic level, which is how you can tell the difference between a lab grown diamond and a natural diamond as well. That's at the, you know, atomic level, you can start to see the differences. We're just getting a new machine in that's going to be able to, you know, determine that on a quite a sophisticated level. So that's how it works.
For biometrics, it's a bit like the way in which we have biometric fingerprints for faces in passports. It's a similar sort of concept.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good analogy. So that you can start to determine that it is actually the diamond. But obviously you need the sophisticated equipment. So a layman wouldn't be able to tell the difference between a lab-grown and the natural versus the other natural, if the, you know, the core, if there's a laser inscription that matches, etc. So but it is getting more sophisticated, and because no two diamonds are exactly identical, you are actually able to do this. But you need that to be recorded, and you need the equipment to be able to match that up. But it's all possible. And so, you know, I think for the consumer, the technology is moving fast enough to be able to continue to give that assurance that what they're buying is real. But you know, you need to buy from a reputable company as well, because there's always people that are able to cheat, and so it is very important that, you know, you've got somebody who's trustworthy that you're dealing with as a consumer, because you, to the naked eye, will not be able to tell the differences.
The lab grown stuff,
yeah,
how's that evolved over recent years? Is that something that's just emerged, or?
Yeah, it has just emerged in a way, but actually it goes back to 1955 when De Beers invented the technology, and they were using it mainly to manufacture industrial diamonds. So only a diamond can cut a diamond.
Yeah.
Diamond drills are, you know, the most, the hardest forms of drills to dig into the ground to make big holes, etc. And they patented the technology and kept it kind of under wraps. And what happened was newer companies came through and started to evolve the technology to the point where they could create gem quality diamonds. And the industry is basically, new players have come through and have started to pitch this as an alternative to natural diamonds. The problem with that is that as manufacturing capacity is increasing, the value of these lab-grown diamonds are obviously falling, to the point where a lab-grown equivalent lab-grown diamond is 60-70% less than a natural diamond. Natural diamonds have limited supply. There's a lot more supply, obviously, now than there was back in history, as mining equipment has gotten, you know. But they need new discoveries, or we're going to run out of diamonds, natural diamonds. And so the value equation, so we think about why diamonds has been used for engagement rings, it's because it is valuable, it's rare, and it's a promise. And if you're using something which is not rare and precious, which is what lab-grown diamonds are slowly becoming, then it loses the impact. And you have lots of precedents of this as well. So if you look at rubies and sapphires, or gemstones have lots of lab-created synthetics. And even in the pearl industry, there's a huge distinction between, you know, kind of a natural pearl and ones that are not, right? From, you know, even if the outer coating is, etc. So what's actually happened is over the years is, you know, the industry and consumers are able to distinguish and recognize that some things are truly rare and other things are, you know, as big a supply as you want. So I think eventually lab-grown diamonds may become something closer to like a Swarovski crystal, which has less intrinsic value than the natural.
And are the lab-grown ones more perfect than natural ones?
So you you can't be more perfect than a perfect diamond. So they're not more perfect. If you think about them, the bulk of them were industrial quality to start with. It's really difficult to grow. It consumes a huge amount of energy. And you're starting to be able to produce perfect ones, but they are as perfect as
a perfect natural one. But I mean, is there something almost though about natural diamonds, the imperfections or the colours or whatever are the...
It's basically, it's the same.
Okay.
It's the same. And you have things like a pink diamond, which is incredibly rare in nature. You know, a thousandth of diamonds are pink versus, you know, white. And in the lab grown, you're able to produce more of them.
Diamonds obviously have a whole load of financial value, and the difference between a natural diamond and a synthetic diamond is reflected in something about the cultural and emotional connections that we have with these things.
Yeah. I think it's true, but first of all, I think what we've done is we've given much more power to the consumer to be able to pick and choose. And I think for the consumers, it's very important that they are, when you go to a store, which is where you'll be buying something that's pre-manufactured, if you're able to configure something or even completely bespoke design it, you are able to create something much more unique and special. No one's going to have exactly the same version of ring or necklace or earrings that you've got. And I think so, you know, you are able to, in some ways, put a lot more emotion into the creation of it. And that manifests itself. You know, I made this, you know, specifically for you. I've configured this for you. I've designed this for you. Makes, I think, the present much more unique and special, and embodies more emotion in many ways than actually I went into a store and bought you something, you know, ready made. So I think the technology and you know, the online capabilities allow people to create. You know, we can now create much more unique things for customers just in time. And I think they really appreciate it. We get, you know, really positive feedback on the configurability of the products, or just the complete bespoke creation. And also people are able to spend much more time researching online. So they're actually putting a lot more effort and emotion into the purchasing process. So I think that's really wonderful. It's evolved in a really positive way. Yeah. And the best thing of all is that social media is around, so that afterwards, you know, we get to share in the emotion of the event, you know, that happens, or the gifting, which, you know, buying, for example, an engagement ring is a very emotional purchase, and hopefully, you know, something that happens once in a lifetime, and being able to be part of that, you know. So our team is very geared to the fact, they're very attuned to our customers who are going through this kind of quite a nervous period of time where they're making a life decision.
Yeah.
And then being able to help them put that into a product is, you know, a really great feeling. And we get, you know, the most amazing feedback from customers. And they're so grateful and thankful for taking the time in a non-pressurized environment, being able to let them express themselves.
What do you see as the long-term future of the jewelry retail industry? Do you think it will be something that moves online, or will we continue to see a mix of traditional physical retailers as well as online retailers?
I think everyone will need to embrace the omni-channel offering, because that is where consumers are today, and increasingly so. They're more demanding. They want to be able to access the products, you know, when and where they want. And so there's, you know, there's always going to be a segment of the market that wants the physical aspect of purchasing jewelry, which I totally understand, because it's a very tangible product. And that's why, you know, we're going to continue to roll out showrooms so that they can access it. It's a very big purchase, many, you know, lots of the time, as well. But making that online experience, you know, as close to what you can get in the showroom, in a non-pressurized kind of way, is also essential to delivering, you know, to the needs of the customers as well. So we're just going to carry on working really hard to make sure that the customers get, you know, a first-class experience the whole way through.
So thank you to Tobias for making the time in his quite luxurious Mayfair offices and showroom a few weeks ago. He didn't give me free samples, which I was a bit upset about, but you know. It's an interesting, I think, the thing that I've been thinking about since I went to see Tobias has been about, if you think about, say, 15 years or so after the first dot-com burst, bubble burst, that sounds like there's a preemptive, there's going to be a second bubble burst. There will be. But the things that maybe about, you know, early 2000s, as Amazon was just starting to become a thing that the broader public was starting to become aware of, but we were still in sort of low bandwidth time. Home broadband was only just starting to become a thing commonly. It was still like 512K, that kind of thing. What were the things that we would have said 15 years ago, there is no way that anybody will buy that online?
Yeah, it's a good question, isn't it? Because now I think about it, I was at that time, I was pretty much, everything I was doing was based around the fact that the internet was there. And then this is an amazing thing. Suddenly you can get your information onto the desktop of the person's, you know, and it's in the business sense, you know, you could, if somebody's got a computer on their desk, you can put your information on their screen and everybody's connected all of a sudden. And those were the opportunities. But in a B2B context, that's fine because you can say, well, you know, you buy these things from us. Wouldn't it be great if you knew how many of those things we had at any one time, so you knew how to plan for your buy or something? So that there was all that. But then there's it's about trust, isn't it? When you buy something, if you're going to buy something, and again, when I was back in the kind of early days, the early 2000s, when I was doing the dot-com stuff, we were thinking about what services can we offer online? And my immediate kind of analog was mail order. If you could do it on mail order, you can do it online, because basically you're just replicating a catalog and you're saying, rather than sending off a form saying, please send me one of those, one of those, and one of those, and here's my check, then you're saying, send me one of those and one of those and one of those, and pressing the button. And then you find somewhere getting a payment, because that wasn't so easy then, because we didn't have all the sort of credit card merchants. So I thought too much about the kind of things you wouldn't, because I was too busy trying to think of the things that you could, if only you could get a payment done. You
know, yeah. And there was also, I mean, thinking about 2000, 2001, my ex-wife was working as a copywriter for Marks and Spencer's on their catalogue. And Marks and Spencer's used to have a mail order catalogue.
Mm-hmm.
Next, of course, had a massive catalogue operation. Quite high production values in all of it when it started in the 80s. Obviously, Argos was there. Argos still chugs away, being a thing that it's like an overpriced Amazon these days, isn't it? Bless it. But then there would be things that you think, oh, would I ever do that? I think actually clothing was, for a lot of people, something that they couldn't get. But, you could do mail order clothing, but there was a lot of people who said they couldn't possibly do that because you can't try it on. I just had a new pair of glasses delivered from Glasses Direct. I've been doing glasses online for about 6 years now, last three pairs I think I've done online. Mostly because I met the CIO of Specsavers, as was, who was at an event a bit drunk and lauding it about the massive profit margins that they made. And that was the point I went, okay, I'm buying online from this point. But there's a stack of things that you just wouldn't have really thought possible. Some still not. I mean, it doesn't look like, although the advertising of houses has moved pretty much online to Rightmove, the actual estate agency bit is as strong as ever, and challenges in that market don't seem to be making the headway that they thought they would. So people like Purple Brick seem to be struggling.
Yeah, that's right. And I think we've talked about that recently, haven't we? And as much as where you've got those value chains where you think, well, that's a classic case for disintermediation. And it really isn't, as much as once upon a time, and I've used this example many times, if you wanted to go and buy a house in Chester, maybe 30 years ago, you would have to drive to Chester and you'd have to, you could drive to Chester and you'd go to the road where the estate agents were, and then you'd go and visit the estate agents and find a house. You could, of course, call them and say, I'm looking for a house with four bedrooms and whatever, but, and they could post you a bunch of literature. But all the information was collated around that physical location where on that road where the estate agents was in every single town. And then the whole internet thing said, well, no, we don't have to worry about that anymore. We can disintermediate all that because we can collect all this information on rightmove.com or Zoopla or whatever. And now you can look at houses in any town you like by, you know, typing the postcode, and you can see all these houses for sale. But as you say, the estate agent's gone away. So they're doing something in the middle, which has value. And I think it's probably going back to that whole trust thing. Now, do we trust estate agents? Yeah, maybe not. But people like to look to people in the eye, and they like to be able to. Very few people are going to buy a house they've never seen. Very few people are going to buy a car they've never seen. I mean, cars are another one, aren't they? And as much as the car sales.
You'll buy a brand new car that you've never
seen. Yeah, you would, but you would like to, I suspect you're more likely to have gone and sat in one before you choose to buy it. Yeah. And they are quite emotional things. Do you know what? Now I'm starting to think about it. Even like mobile phones, right? You'll buy a mobile phone online, of course you will. But you won't buy a mobile phone unless you've picked it up and had a look at it.
Well, it's only recently you've been able to go into a mobile phone shop and pick it up and use it in store, because forever they were just little dummy ones.
Yeah, that is true.
If you go way back, WH Smith's, when you were buying computer games on cassette, weren't allowed to play them before you had to just buy, you know, computer games, you still had to take the plungers out.
That is true. But I would then, again, I would contend that with the mobile phone, you will have used somebody else's phone. I want one of those phones. You're not going to, I don't think many people bought a phone because of the plastic dummy one they saw in the orange shop. And also computer games, you were either one of those people, a bit like buying a record, you're buying it on trust because this particular producer was making this, because computer games, like we're buying, you know, I like
it's Ultimate, or it's Ocean.
And I like, you know, The Cure or whatever it is. I'm going to buy their new album. Or you've seen somebody else has got it. So I think there are things that are quite emotional or quite, and it is, it's a good thing. So, and the reason I went to mobile phones is if you're at work, what are the things that people get really exercised about? They get excited about phones, right? They don't want a crappier phone than their colleagues. They get excited about company cars. You know, those are things that still have a level of kind of, you know, emotional attachment to them for whatever reason, whether it's status or just having the latest dealy, or, you know, when iPads started to come by and then boards, the CEOs decided that they needed an iPad, and then of course the whole board needed an iPad, and they didn't really know what they wanted it for, but they had to have one because obviously, you know, it was an iPad. So these things, I think there's something in the emotional kind of link, which then takes us on to jewellery, of course, because that's another reason why you'd think people wouldn't do it, because it was, why do you sit with your wife-to-be and choose the engagement ring on Amazon, or do you go to the jewellery stores and look in windows and gaze into each other's eyes with a sense of everlasting togetherness? And that's why it was interesting that in your interview, there was this conversation about the fact that when it started, it wasn't really about that. It was about, it was quite geeky, quite technical around how the diamond was cut or the way it was sourced or the way, you know, all that kind of stuff, which is a bit more of a B2B sale than a B2C sale. But you know what I mean? It's a bit more autistic. It's not about the emotional value of it.
Yeah, something there about selling to geeks. So the other thing, obviously big news over the last 24 hours as we're recording this, is the demise of Thomas Cook, the travel agents and tour operator. And there's been a lot of noise around that. I think the kind of commentary noise around that has been it was stuck in an old world business model and hadn't adapted to the modern world. It had been destroyed by Brexit, not entirely, but because of particularly the exchange rate changes over the last few months, they got hammered because they had outstanding debts of up to 90, or payments of up to 90 days, and so therefore they were having to pay out a lot more than they thought they were going to. Bits about over the last few years, how much money the directors have taken in bonuses, and is that an indication of how you incentivize great performance in public listed companies. The bit for me, though, is if you look at the model, essential model of travel agency, don't think about it from a quality of holiday perspective, but more the idea of buying up hotel rooms and buying up flights on bulk with discount and then passing on some of that discount as packages. That feels to me to be a very internet era business model.
It really is, isn't it? And you look at one of the tour operators, which is doing quite well, as far as I can tell. You know, I'm not an expert in this, but like, so look at Jet2, for example, who are, as far as I can tell, completely internet based, but they have their own airline and they have their own, and we've been on Jet2 holidays. You know, I think that they're a really good company. They seem to have their head screwed on. Are they the cheapest? Probably not. You know, and there are Travel Republic and all these sort of things that will cobble together a holiday for you and they'll book you on a Ryanair flight and all of that kind of thing. And then there's the package holidays. But the difference between Thomas Cook, of course, and Jet2 is Jet2 haven't got a bunch of stores all around the country with all the overhead that goes with retail space, etc. And Co-op travel agents, they got out of that market, didn't they, quite recently? And they sold all their shops to Thompson, was it, or TUI? Is that right? So, but then TUI, there's a international travel agency package holiday operator which really does still have stores all over the place, and I saw them when I was in Europe, and you see them everywhere. So not necessarily a bad thing. And if you're the kind of person that wants to get a really good service, generally speaking, if you go into a travel agent to book a holiday, the person you speak to is really enthusiastic about what they do. You know what, they love to talk about holidays. They love to talk about the resort. They love to talk about the hotel. And generally speaking, if you get a good one, they know about the hotel. They've got colleagues that have been there or they've been there. You go to Trail Finders, for example, you know, which is a bit more of a specialist kind of thing, but they can take that a bit further. And you go in there and people will talk about this hotel in Singapore or Australia or Durban or wherever it might be. So I think that a bit like estate agency, there's something to be added there. Genuinely something to be added, rather than as I would do, because can I be bothered to go into it? No, I mean, if it's there, then I might do, and I have done, but often I'll go online and I'll use TripAdvisor for all of the sort of caveats about the, you know, bought reviews and things like that. I think if you're discerning, you can kind of tell whether they're good or bad, you know, and you don't just use TripAdvisor, you use different, and then you find the best value, best thing that you can get for in your price range, and you can pretty much do okay. So I think there's a different people have different needs, don't they? And if you can meet them all in the right, in that nexus of cost and service and trust, then you're doing okay. I don't know. I just never thought to go on a Thomas Cook holiday recently. It didn't, not because I knew they were in trouble. I mean, I kind of did know they were in trouble. But did I not go with Thomas Cook because I thought they were in trouble? No, I think I just didn't. They just seemed to be kind of old fashioned, and yeah. Why would you bother?
And interestingly, actually, back in 2010, so when you were doing your internet startup stuff that didn't go anywhere, I was doing internet startup stuff that didn't go anywhere, but I did teach a mate of mine, Phil, to be able to code, and we sort of fiddled around and did stuff and nothing really came of it. And then he and another mate of mine set up this business that they started off doing web design, and then out the back of little bits that I'd taught him, and then he did a load of learning himself. They set up an online travel insurance business, and they built that, and they built it, and they built it. In 2010, they sold it for quite a bit of money to Thomas Cook, who within 2 years had completely destroyed it. So the other thing was that they did try to be able to diversify into different sorts of internet-based business models. But the classic thing of trying to be able to acquire to be able to get into there, that's really hard, because if you're a big lumbering organization who started your business 156 years ago by selling package tours to Loughborough, then you know you've got a lot of culture and a lot of history there, which is going to make it hard to be able to adapt to the sorts of things that are going on now. So but there we go. Anyway, thanks again to Tobias. We'll put a link to 77 Diamonds on the website at wp40podcast.com. So finally, before we wrap up this week, you've been reading a book. Well done. It's about AI.
It is kind of about AI. And it was a birthday present for my recent birthday. I don't remember anybody else sending me a book, Matt. But yes, it was a present from my brother. And I was interested in it because it was about, you know, everybody's got to write a book these days about AI and the singularity and all that carry on, haven't they? But I was quite interested because the author, I think, is quite a sensible soul. And it was as much around the human side of it as around the technology. Although there's kind of a decent, it's kind of a decent fist of bringing a sense of what the technology is doing and how it's doing it in the first part of the book. But quite a lot of the book, and probably more than I was expecting, is about rationality, about this rationalist movement. Yes, about these people that believe in the singularity and believe that, yeah, he says quite early on, the author Tom Chivers, that somebody said to him, one of these guys had said, "Oh, you know, your children won't die of old age," and he's like, "Oh no, no, I'm really freaked out by that statement," because the choices are, of course, that your children will either become essentially immortal because of the great strides made by artificial intelligence in empowering the human race to ever greater things, or they'll be, you know, destroyed by the hideous mess that AI makes of everything. So that's kind of where a lot of the book goes, into understanding this kind of rationalist community. And I think it's probably, from my point of view, that's a little bit of a shame, because as I was reading about these rationalists, and I've seen some of these arguments before, of course, I kept coming back to that episode we did a few weeks ago about Dominic Cummings, about the fact that he said at one point, we need to recruit from the top like 5% of the ability curve or something like that. And in the rationalist world, there's this idea that there's only certain people who have the sort of mental capacity to understand these different levels of future shock before they start to sort of, they can't deal with it, and therefore they're not quite the ubermensch that the top guys are. And you have to be in this 4SL bracket. And if you're in this 4SL bracket, the level 4 shock level or something, you are then seen to be one of the top rationalists, and you get all of the, you know, you're in the top forums because your brain is big enough to cope with this. And this is always a red flag for me, because it's like, oh, there's these really clever people like me, and that's just like Cummings. We need to have more of these really clever people a bit like me. And they put themselves in this bracket because they have a certain way of looking at things, or a certain, you know, these guys are not dumb, in as much as really, really good coders aren't dumb, but a really, really good coder can't make your cat better if your cat's ill, and they can't mend a broken relationship, right? That's they've got a superpower, but it's limited. And these guys are really limited, because again, they're a bit like Cummings, and a bit all these people who think they can model the universe, they just haven't got a clue. And I'm afraid I get quite impatient with them. So in as much as it is a good book, and it really does, it's a good run through their little world and how they see AI as being this kind of this all powerful force that's going to come and do something, I also feel that, given my conclusion that they are wrong, it could be, you know, that those guys, they could have spent less time on those guys, I think.
I had an interesting conversation actually with an academic who I'm going to see if I can get convince her to come on the show at some point. A lady called Joanna Bryson, who's a researcher into AI and ethics and stuff around the whole technology space. And the conversation started out with a tweet she'd put out saying about how you shouldn't talk about ethics in AI, you should just talk about ethics in software. And at that point, I kind of said, well, maybe you should just think actually more broadly, it's just about ethics in organizations. And then I thought about it a bit more and said, no, it's ethics in the people who run organizations. And actually, the trying to be able to put the responsibility for regulation and whatever onto inanimate objects is, I think, part of the problem. And that actually feeds into this idea that, you know, AI is not intelligent. It is not. It is code. It is as much an inanimate object as a brick is an inanimate object. And that we should stop thinking that any of the decision making around any of this stuff should be imbued into inanimate objects. It's people that are the important bit here. And often it's the people in charge who are the ones who have to be able to take ethical responsibility for the decisions that they take. And again, I think this is the kind of the rationalist thing, the sorts of, you know, the as long as it isn't totally illegal, we'll do it, belies a complete lack of ethical framework amongst these people. And you look at the Ubers of this world, and you look at the Travises of Uber of this world, and you think these people don't actually have any of the underpinnings of what we need people with serious power and responsibility to have to be able to make decisions.
Well, that's true, and it is about people at the end of the day, and it's a little bit of a. So, first of all, I had this conversation with somebody not so long ago, and I'd been to Brussels, and you know they have those little lime scooters. There are some in some parts of London, but they are essentially illegal in the UK. You can't really ride them anywhere. But people were saying, "Oh, they're terrible." You know, the people leave them everywhere, and they just clutter up the streets. And then somebody, you know, nearly run over by one, and all this kind of thing. But I can't help thinking that that's got nothing to do with the scooters. That's got to do with assholes that ride them. If somebody's going to run into you because they can't be bothered to operate something safely, or if somebody's going to leave it in the way, in the middle of the road, then it's got nothing to do with the technology at all. Yeah, you could say that, all right, let's not have these because people aren't behaving well on them. But it isn't really anything to do with the device. It's to do with whether, as a person, you believe that you've got any kind of responsibility for somebody else or not. And sadly, there are a lot of people, you know, they're the kind of people who park in disabled spaces, or the kind of people that will come and take things from your house when you're not there. There are lots of people, or the kind of people who will quite happily let hoteliers take bookings and put people up and then close down a company because they've got as much money as they possibly can before they have to start paying it out. There are people who want more of the pie than anybody else. That is the problem. And that is human nature, I guess. So you can't really get away from that. So the question is how do you manage the whole thing?
Yeah, I keep coming back to the, was it Joel Bakken, the book, The Corporation, who's made a film of it as well. And one of the core ideas in that book and film is the psychological profile of the corporation as a psychopath. And I think there's still so much in that actually the singular, you know, shareholder value is the only thing that's important, that everything else comes second. We will put aside our emotions to be able to do things that otherwise we would not possibly do. There is something about the rewarding of psychopathic traits in senior management leadership positions that actually reinforces a lot of this stuff. And the modern tech industry, I think, is particularly susceptible to this nonsense. And I think the rationalist thing has probably got a part to play in that.
Yeah, and we had a conversation, didn't we, in the group, the WB40 group the other week about private equity and startups and things like that. And at the end of the day, if you get involved in that, you have to be comfortable that you are trying to get more of the pie. There's going to be a pie. And if you want to get an exit and have some money, then you're going to have to fight for your bit of that pie. And as you fight for that bit of that pie, part of the outcome of that is that somebody else is going to get less of that pie. And that is just the way it is. You have to be comfortable with that before you start. And it doesn't matter how much you try to dissemble and pretend it's not happening. It really is.
Thank you for listening. You can find us at wb40podcast.com. You can find us on Twitter at wb40podcast. And you can find us on all good podcasting platforms. And if you want to join the WhatsApp group, just drop us a line on Twitter and we'll send you the magic link.